Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And it's great to have you back as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation. Those of you listening on the radio can also hear us commercial free online at promiseoftomorrow.biz. Another exciting program today in the first half hour. We're going to get a visit from an old friend of ours, David McIntyre. He's the VP of Homeland Security Programs at the National Graduate School. And in preparation for a program that we're doing next week, he gave us some pretty good insight on things that are going on this week as far as cybersecurity goes. You're going to find it fascinating. Today we're gonna visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from some of us a lot of us never heard of, visit the fountain of useless information we have here in the second half of the program, and of course at the end of the program, listener comments and the voice of reason. We're also going to have a special guest, Byron Reese. He's Chief Innovation Officer for Demand Media in Austin, Texas. He's a speaker at the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference 2012, going on October 21st through the 24th in Seattle, Washington. You can learn more about that conference at our website, promiseoftomorrow.biz. Just go to the right-hand side of your screen, and you will see a link. And Byron's pretty fascinating. He's talking about the end of war, and he said it's coming sooner rather than later. Just a minute here. I want to check in with David McIntyre. This is from a conversation that he and I had this week. We're preparing a program that we're going to be doing next week, as a matter of fact, on border security. And he has some pretty devastating things to tell us about that, some things that a lot of people may not want to hear, and things that you probably haven't considered. But anyway, we kind of deviated from that conversation a little bit and started to talk about cybersecurity. And he really gave us some insight on that, and I want to play that for you now. So here is an excerpt from a conversation that David McIntyre and I had this week in preparation for the program that's going to air next week right here on this radio program. I want to take kind of a right turn here and get into something that you're pretty familiar with, and that's cybersecurity. We've talked about that on a number of occasions, too. I mean, in fact, this program has devoted a lot of time to talking about, do we, you know, scrap the Internet and rebuild it so it's more secure? Are we going to be able to make the current Internet secure? There's a bill that has been in the Senate. That the senators all went on vacation and didn't address. I think Lieberman is leading the way on that particular bill, which has to do with the cybersecurity. Give us a picture of where we are there and what we have to look forward to.
Well, this all is generated by several things. One of them, actually, although the Republicans ended up being a large part of the force that blocked the bill going forward, Republican committee members actually helped to generate this to begin with. A Republican report was done about a year ago that looked at the threat of cybersecurity. Mac Thornberry is a Republican from Texas who's been pursuing this for 10 or 12 years, and that report and others since then have been very alarming about what's happening. The head of our cyber command, the guy supposedly charged with Defense of America, General Keith Alexander, spoke recently and said he thinks that cyber attacks have already created the largest transfer of wealth in history. Think about that. Larger than any war where one country conquered another. The largest transfer of wealth. And there's just no question that on a daily basis, our intelligence agencies are thoroughly penetrated. Our companies are being penetrated. Our banks are being penetrated and robbed. And you and I are at risk with money that can be moved. You know, when I talk to groups about what does cybersecurity mean, the very first cybercrime that I ever personally saw, the first one I ever personally saw, was almost 20 years ago now, when the Internet was just coming up. And I was aware of a hospital that put its records online to make it easier for doctors and nurses, and someone penetrated the hospital, didn't have a firewall, and changed blood types for patients. Just maliciously. This wasn't the Chinese with battalions of people, just malicious behavior. So is there a threat? You bet there is. Now let me pause and put this in personal perspective. There was a time when automobiles first hit the road that anybody could drive without a license, and anybody who made a car could put it on the road without a safety inspection, and there were no national standards. And that is the way we built the internet. You, without any training, go to a local store, big box, buy your computer, plug it into the internet, and you are free to use it. There are no rules or restrictions over you or your computer, and you are dangerous because your computer is immediately accessible to anybody in the world who wants to capture it, turn it into a bot, and use it against other companies and so forth. General Alexander, the head of the Cyber Command, says about a third of the emails sent globally every day is trash email generated by bots, many of them on company, but lots of them on private computers. Now, let me ask your listening public this question. Are you willing to be licensed the same way that you have to be licensed to drive a car in order to use a computer? Are you willing to have your computer checked for safety the same way that your car is checked to make sure it's safe to operate on the road? Are you willing to have some national standards for safety and security in the same way that we have national standards that got rid of glass and replaced it with safety glass in automobiles and require airbags? If that strikes you as absolutely outrageous and outlandish, then let me tell you, we're going to continue to have a cyber problem. Because until people, individuals, companies are as concerned about safety and security as you and I are when we drive down the road with the children and the grandchildren in the back seat, until they have that kind of interest, we're going to continue to have essentially unsafe wrecks cruising the highway looking for a disaster.
Wow. So you're saying that we have got to put in place then permission for people to get on the internet, and that's the answer is not scrapping the internet as we know it and rebuilding it more safely. The answer is to not only make it safer through the way it currently exists, but that the users of the internet can't access it without proper license and proper oversight. Is that what you're saying?
No. I've been careful not to give you a solution. What I'm trying to describe in very dramatic terms is the problem. And so I hope that my metaphor there, my comparison to the automobile, catches your listening audience's attention and that they understand that just like every company that puts big rigs on the road, if that company is not inspecting their brakes and qualifying their drivers, then they have got a lethal weapon on the road endangering you. And the same is true of any driver that gets on there without driving skills. You know, if you get a 14-year-old that steals a car and gets on the road without driving skills or drives drunk, that person is a threat to you, your life, and your family. And the same is true of the internet highway. If people are operating on there without skills and without protection, without any brakes, without any safety equipment, we've all got a problem. And so I've tried to be dramatic enough in my warning, but without saying, well, this is what we have to do, to get people's attention and understand this cyber bill or something like it is desperately needed, because in the same way that in 1905 there's lots of room on the highway for any kind of driver, not the case today at 75 miles an hour the high speed lane. And we've moved in the internet from the times everybody remembers just buy your computer and plug it in to today we have a high powered computer online in your house, which if not operated properly is a threat to other people. We got to think about what to do about that.
So you're not saying that that permission and oversight is the only answer, but you're saying that is the most obvious answer right now.
Well, I'll take it even a little further. What I'm trying to we've worked together. You know that I'm a strategist. My approach is cause and effect. I'm
absolutely
not
yeah.
an operator. Do this. Here's
absolutely
a list of four things. Enjoyed your show. My forte is challenging people to think about cause and effect over time.
Okay.
All right?
Yep.
Now, let me just ask you, if you have on your machine, if you have not properly configured your firewall and not bought the proper software to protect your machine, and your machine is seized, and your machine is used to damage my computer, don't I have a legal recourse against you if we could identify who that is? Can't you see the day coming when individuals are going to have legal recourse against companies and individuals who have been thoughtless in their own protection of their own software. And don't we need to do something now rather than wait until that happens? If that hospital had given you the wrong blood type because they failed to secure their software, the hospital I talked about earlier, do you think you should have legal recourse against them? So isn't this something we better act on now? Hadn't that hospital better protect itself now? Don't I, as a patient, want to know they protect themselves before I check in? So you began this by asking, describe to me the sort of the oversight, the significance of the cyber problem. And you said your listeners are familiar with this because you spent a lot of time on the technical issues. And I've listened to your show. I know that's the case. What I'm trying to do is drive home to your listeners, this is not some technical thing that geeks and nerds need to worry about. This is you, when you turn on your computer, the day is rapidly coming when you are both endangered and a danger to others in the improper use of an improper machine, improperly configured. And so we better be thinking right now, before we get into a big mess, a legal mess, operational mess, we better be thinking about how to, what are the rules of the road now that we've moved from the early days of the automobile to high-speed interstates. What are the rules of the road as we've moved to a much more sophisticated internet system?
Well, David, you make a very compelling argument for what seems to be the more equitable solution to letting things go on the way they are or completely throwing out the internet and rebuilding it. I mean, this is a whole other way of looking at things, and so maybe people will take that to heart. But the Lieberman bill in the Senate doesn't go anywhere near that, I don't think, does it? That bill is really pretty limited. Isn't that one of the reasons why the Republicans have been stalling it?
It was pretty limited and watered. It was very much watered down to get back to the individual bills. What you ended up with is business, and I won't blame only business. There were a number of individuals who lobbied as well, but business is resisting regulation. They don't want some federal government telling them what the minimum standards are that they have to meet for cybersecurity. And you know what? I understand why. Here's an important part of the argument, which they actually have not made very articulately, but is very important. If we put regulations in place today, by the time they were all penetrate the government as a whole, by the time you have inspectors, by the time business is dealing with them, well, software and threats have completely changed. The software and threats from today, just look at your phone, the difference in the last 2 years. So I understand the business argument against regulation. Hey, you're going to write regulations that deal with the software I used to have, and you're going to make a huge nightmare for me. I get their argument. On the other hand, we've seen over and over and over that the argument that, well, I'll just police myself, it's in my self-interest, this simply doesn't happen. We had the same argument with the chemical industry for about 10 years. Oh, we're going to create our own standards, we're going to police ourselves, we'll take care of the threat by ourselves. And what they found was that about 80 to 90% of the chemical industry was very responsible, led by people who have families, and they don't want your family hurt either. They don't want tarnish their profit or their reputation. 80 to 90% of chemical companies in the chemical industry was absolutely willing to cooperate in Homeland Security. And 10% just wouldn't. And so we've had to have strong federal regulation, not for the 90% that cooperated, but for the 10% that wouldn't. So here's the question, the challenge for the Lieberman bill and those people who objected to it. I got it that you don't want burdensome regulation. What's the solution then? What incentive system do you put together for the 10% of free riders who are simply not going to protect their machines and leave the public, you know, open to the damage that comes to them? My own thought is that we need to have stronger legal penalties against those people who don't protect themselves and leave us open. You know, if people are going to operate a power plant and won't come up to some standards, I didn't say regulation standards, and that power plant goes down, because of that, then we need to make them liable to the people who suffered damage. We've got to have some negative incentives as well as positive incentives if we're going to try to do this the way business wants, which is not through regulation, but through assistance and information and helping and encouraging them. So I just don't know, frankly, if we can get there from here. I fear regulation. I'm not sure there's another way.
Well, that was Dr. David McIntyre, VP of Homeland Security Programs at the National Graduate School, nationally recognized strategist, analyst, and teacher in national and homeland security. That's from a conversation that David and I had this week in preparation for a program that we're going to air next week right here, same time, same station, on border security. David has some pretty devastating things to say about border security, some things you may not have considered and things a lot of people may not want to hear. That's next week, the same time. Right now, though, I want to get on to today's guest, Byron Reese, who believes that he sees an end to war soon. Let's dial him up here, huh?
Stand by.
Well, today we have a fascinating guest with us. He's Byron Reese is Chief Innovation Officer for Demand Media in Austin, Texas. He's a very accomplished guy. He's a speaker at the Global Humanitarian Conference that we're giving a lot of coverage to on this program that's going on in Seattle, October 21st through the 24th. Byron's an author. He's an expert in crowdsourcing and psychographics and just an all-around fascinating guy. Welcome to the program, Byron.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Now, before we get too deep into what we're talking about, you're with an organization called Demand Media in Austin, Texas. You're doing things like crowdsourcing and psychographics. Now, for those of us wide-eyed and saying, what is all that stuff, can you give us an indication what Demand Media is all about and what crowdsourcing and psychographics are?
Well, Demand Media is a publishing company that publishes a number of websites, including ones like eHow or Crack.com or Livestrong.com.
Mm-hmm.
And the crowdsourcing aspect is based on kind of an underlying philosophy of the company, and that is that everyone has something that they know that would be a benefit to someone else. And so what we try to do is get different people in different walks of life with different skills to write, or in some cases write or video content that would be of use to other people. Psychographics is more part of a science, trying to figure out the best content to show somebody what they might be interested in,
mm-hmm.
Based in part on other things they've been interested in the past. And so it's a way that, in an internet that is increasingly full of content, that you match people with things that would be interesting to them.
All right. Well, there's you've got a fascinating book coming out, Golden Age 2.0, How Technology is Going to End Poverty, Disease, Hunger, Ignorance, and War. And that is going to be fascinating. I hope we can talk a little bit about that. But I really want to get into the talk that you're going to give at the Global Humanitarian Conference, Big Data and the Coming Golden Age of Humanity. Can you expand on that a little bit for us?
Yes, it's everybody's familiar with this notion of big data, that there's these enormously large databases that are being created, and they're full of all kinds of different things. And that for the first time, we kind of have cheap enough storage and cheap enough processing that you can have enormous amounts of data and do meaningful things with them.
Mm-hmm.
So this particular talk is based. You mentioned the book, and it talks about how the internet technology will end, and one of them was ignorance. And so this talk is a lot about that, which says that if you think about it, humanity doesn't really have a very robust memory. You know, if you think about it, mankind doesn't really have much of a collective memory at all. Up until recently, the nature of information has been very fragile, and that somebody would learn something, and then if they died, everything they knew died with them, unless they hopefully had taught someone else what they knew, and that someone may have misremembered it or changed it or not thought it was worth passing down. And so that what happens is knowledge is fragile, and when people would learn something one place, somebody else would have to relearn it, and so forth. But then that changed a bit when the modern book was invented, and not just invented, but it's widespread propagation very inexpensively. And what that meant is that ideas were persistent. They didn't die with the person. They lived beyond the person. And people started gathering all these books up and putting them in libraries, these enormous storehouses of information. But that actually introduced an interesting problem, which is that if you know somewhere in that library is the answer that you need, but you can't find it, it effectively doesn't exist. And it's kind of lost in a way. And so what we're getting in the digital age is the ability, first of all, just to have information far more accessible and far more findable. But if you think about everything you do in life, more and more will leave a digital echo. In other words, a sensor or a recording or a camera or something will track it.
Yeah.
Much like when you buy something with your credit card, all of that information, you know, where you were at and what you bought and what you spent and what time it was, is saved. It's like a digital echo of your life. It is, and that what is happening is the whole planet is getting one of these kinds of digital echoes, where the billions of causes and effects that happen every day of outcomes, circumstances, are getting logged. And what's going to happen is computers will churn on that, and ever more sophisticated kind of self-teaching algorithms will learn kind of best practices for humanity. And this effectively means that humanity has this extremely robust collective memory, that everything anybody does and learns from benefits somebody else. And what this means is that it will even manifest itself in extremely mundane ways. Like if you're thinking, where should I go to dinner tonight? I'm in San Francisco and I want Italian food. It would look at billions and billions of factors, like every place you've eaten and liked and went back to, and other people who ate at the same places and went back to. Where did they go for Italian food in San Francisco? And where do people in San Francisco drive the farthest to get their Italian food? And 1,000, 10,000, 100,000 other factors will all come together and give you a simple answer. You should eat at Tomaso's on Kearney Street. And that will effectively make everybody in the world vastly wiser than any person who's ever lived, because everybody will have at their disposal, at a very high and abstracted level, the learning of everybody who came before them.
This is...
You would actually be able to go through life always knowing the best thing to do. Now, I won't speculate as to whether we will always choose the best thing, but you will always go through life knowing the best thing to do. And so, if you think about the toll that ignorance has taken on... Like every time you've done something and there was a better outcome, the aggregate of that across humanity is enormous. You know, one guy made one wrong turn that started essentially World War One, which led to the Depression, which led to World War Two, which led to the Cold War, and 100 million people died, all because one guy made a wrong turn. I mean, that's the way that ignorance and decisions based on bad information kind of ripple through history. And I think we're going to see the end of that. We're going to optimize for human existence.
Are you saying that Archduke Ferdinand should have been taking a different route, and somebody laid for him and shot him in Sarajevo and started World War One? Is that what you're talking about, the wrong turn?
Exactly. Actually, there was a plot to shoot the Archduke that day, and it looked like it was going to fail. And so the guy who ended up doing it kind of gave up, and he went and to a delicatessen. He was eating a sandwich, and Leopold Loika, I think was the name of the driver, took the wrong turn. And when he realized that, he slammed on the brakes and the car stalled. And you can just imagine the guy there with the sandwich. All of a sudden, there's the Archduke Leonel right in front of you. He strolls over there and kills him. And, of course, that had Leopold Loika had a GPS, had he had a Garmin, maybe, you know, 100 million people wouldn't have died. I mean, that's what ignorance does. It has these horrible ramifications through history. And even in little parts of your life, just imagine if you had the benefit of hindsight of 100 generations of everybody's lives, how that could inform what you do, the choices you make in your life, right down to where to go to school or what profession to enter or you will have essentially something advising you with enormous amount of wisdom built into it. You know, we see hints of that with Amazon, right? Like I go to Amazon and I buy something and it says, hey, you may be interested in this. The way it does that, and I wager anybody who shops on that site has bought something that it's recommended, because what it has is untold numbers of transactions of people who bought this and this and this and this and how they rated it and all of this. And so Amazon is able to recommend things based on this kind of collective learning in this very narrow sector of what to buy. And it's starting to be actually useful. And you can just flash forward. When everything you do, everything is recorded.
This is really hard to imagine, Byron. I mean, okay, hold that thought. We'll be right back. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all of the wisdom of mankind. In the Den of Strangers, will we meet today?
Edgar Wallace. I'm going to ask what the definition is of a highbrow. A highbrow. It's someone who's found something more interesting than women.